I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's pretty dire when we talk about the media and the state of Canadian journalism, as we do on this program from time to time. A new book looks at the state of Canada's media and suggests some ways to save it. The book is called No News is Bad News, Canada's Media Collapse and What Comes Next. It's a hopeful book with some useful insights as to how to make the media, or as to how the media works and why it's in the state it's in, who's responsible and the sort. The examples of how it could be salvaged are rather interesting as well. Ian Gill is the author of three earlier books, All That We Say Is Ours, Gujao, and The Reawakening of the Haida Nation is the most recent. He's a former editor and reporter at the Vancouver Sun and was a documentary reporter at CBC Television until 1994. He left journalism to found Echo Trust Canada. This new book is published by Greystone in partnership with the David Suzuki Institute. He writes regularly for the TAI and is president of Discourse Media. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ian Gill. Mr. Gill, good morning.
Good morning to you. It's very good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. What sort of coverage have you been getting for this book? And I'm curious to know from say, what we'd call the traditional media, the so-called legacy media, if you will.
Well, not so much coverage so far, Joe, in terms of the legacy media, you know, the big newspapers and everything else. In part, I believe, because, well, every author likes to think their book's great and everyone should review it and fall down on their knees and buy multiple copies, and hopefully that'll happen.
Yeah.
But, and so you want to get reviewed, you want to get the message out there to some degree. I think partly some of the legacy media are kind of avoiding this book. In fact, a couple of them have just said that flat out. Not because they don't think the book or the argument has merit, but because they're so, frankly, traumatized by what's happening to their industry that they don't really want to, you know, publicize a book that is drawing attention to that, which is actually part of the problem in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a vibrant sort of media criticism culture here. We never really have had. And so the decline of our media has kind of mostly taken place in the dark because the media haven't reported, if you will, on their own demise. And that's the point I make in the book, which is that, you come on, people, pay attention to what's happening. This is an important industry. If you were reporting on the auto industry and it was shedding thousands of jobs, you know, it'd be on the front page. Why is what's happening to our media essentially not on the front pages? It's because it, I guess to some degree it sends a signal to the market that this is a troubled industry, and probably you don't want to send that signal to the market. I don't know.
So it is a troubled industry, and it has been for a while. Where does it go from here? I mean, if you had to project where the state of the Canadian media would be, say, 5-10 years down the road, I mean, what does a landscape look like?
Well, fewer newspapers, firstly, I think, and I spend more time probably in the book on the newspaper industry than I do on any other aspect of the media. So, you know, the ownership concentration model that has, you know, plagued Canadian newspapers for the last 30 or 40 years is finally coming home to roost. You have these large conglomerates that are debt-ridden, owned by hedge funds that want their, you know, their tithe, if you will, before anything else. And so you have declining reporting capacity, declining readership, and as you give less to your readers, which is what these newspapers are doing. The readers aren't stupid. They're just starting to say, well, we don't need this anymore. And, you know, so they're not buying. And therefore, you know, the advertisers are less interested because they're getting fewer eyeballs on their ads. And, you know, so that's a downward spiral that will, I think, play itself out in the next 10 to 15 years to the point that even more communities than is currently the case, and there are way too many communities now that don't have a decent newspaper, even more won't have a decent newspaper. There'll be some further consolidation in the newspaper industry, and whether newspapers will become as kind of rare as hen's teeth, or to quote somebody that I do in the book in Germany, saying that eventually newspapers will be like vinyl records, whether that's actually going to happen, I don't know. I think there'll always be some market somewhere for newspapers, but I don't think they're going to look anything like they do now. And frankly, that's a good thing because they look lousy right now.
So you spoke of media concentration, and that's been the trend, as you said, for the last 30, 40 years or so. The number of outlets, the number of owners has declined in the hands of fewer people. Could that have been stopped at all?
It could have been stopped back in the 70s when people had taken the Davy Commission seriously. It could have been stopped in the 80s when there was the Kent Royal Commission into newspaper ownership and concentration, because, again, of a big sort of bloodletting in newspapers then. There was another, not a royal commission, but another review done a few years ago. Right now, actually, Hedy Fry's Committee of Heritage is doing a review of the newspaper industry, and Melanie Jolie's, also the Minister of Heritage, is doing a CanCon review, and Canadian Content Review, in the sort of more digital media realm. This government has been, not this government, successive governments in Canada have been awash in analysis and dire warnings about concentration and about broken media models, and they've basically done nothing over 30 or 40 years. So this was all avoidable, the problem is we didn't avoid it, so now it's come home to roost.
So where's the public in all of this? I mean, it's one thing for you as someone who's worked in the business, and myself who's a media consumer, you know, pretty much since I was a kid. Where's the public, the rest of the people? I mean, do they lament the loss of newspapers, the lack of outlets of media that they can consume? And, I mean, if we look at the numbers, they aren't consuming them anyway.
Well, I mean, I think there's people of a certain age who are still buying newspapers, and good on them, although they're getting a lot less for their money. They're getting a lot less for more money. There's a certain demographic, you know, the older crowd in the country, and obviously there's a big that's a big demographic. So that still is sustaining an interest in traditional media, although it is declining pretty rapidly. And the other end of the spectrum, I mean, ask around kids, you know, anyone from teenagers on up into sort of mid-20s or even, you know, early 30s, I guess now. Yeah, how many of them are picking up a newspaper and reading it? Hardly anybody. I mean, you might pick up one of those metros on the SkyTrain or something, but that's hardly really a newspaper. Interestingly, there is an amazing consumption of journalistic product, and the public's curiosity, I don't think, is any more diminished now than it was traditionally. And in fact, our world, for most people, makes a lot less sense these days than it ever has. So I think there's a great demand for journalism that is a public service, that sort of helps people make sense of their lives and helps people make good decisions and helps people understand when bad decisions are being made on their behalf by governments or whomever else. Those essential services and that sort of relationship between the public and media haven't changed that much. And in fact, if anything, there's the possibility that those relationships can be better satisfied by digital media and everything else, as the old kind of constricted model of who gets to read what and say what kind of dies as newspapers die. So So where is the public on this? The public, I think, is sick of having its intelligence insulted by badly designed and badly delivered media, and is now looking for where to get information more intelligently and, frankly, especially in the case of younger people, get information on the platforms that they're already using, which increasingly, of course, is their phone. You know, so people who are attuned to how to get good content to younger people are going to survive. People who aren't are not.
How do you square the fact that we are still curious, that we would still consume media, and that we want to know what's going on, with the fact that, because you talk about this in the book, that there are sectors of our population that are woefully underserved or underrepresented in not only in the news media but in the coverage that the media does?
Well, they are, and so therefore they're going to sites. I mean, so a lot of people are consuming their news through your Google and Facebook and Twitter, for instance. That's, you know, is that a bad thing? I mean, I think the sort of stranglehold they have on advertising means that it's a bad thing for traditional media that sort of to some degree get over it. What does it actually mean for public discourse? I think that there's something fascinating about the fact that people get their news largely from somewhere like Facebook, for instance, because it's, in some ways, it democratizes access. I mean, there are First Nations communities, for instance, in the north of this country who have never had really any kind of mainstream media access at all. And they're very active, a lot of these communities, on Facebook now. You know, the problem is that some of the algorithms, or many of the algorithms that Facebook and these other sites use to determine what turns up in your feed, are highly manipulated and not necessarily the best thing for your freedom of speech and democracy. But at least there are platforms there that people can use. One of the problems, however, is that these platforms are very expert at feeding people information that the algorithms say is of interest to them. So what that tends to do then is to reinforce the fact that you only read the news that you already believe in. Mm-hmm. You know, so the exchange of uncomfortable or different ideas is somewhat sort of eradicated by the fact that these platforms are only serving to feed you what you already decided by your choices, what your interests are. It doesn't make for a lot of diversity of opinion and a really plural and sort of exciting exchange of ideas.
So I guess I'm naive enough to think that if our desire for information and facts and the sort of is remains high, yet there are segments of the population or issues that aren't being covered, I would have expected that because our interest is so high, we would demand for that. And so this goes into another idea, but who pays for all this? Because, I mean, if we can get it off of Facebook or Twitter, we aren't paying for it per se.
Right.
So we're not getting the quality? Is that, I mean, but how do you train a generation who hasn't paid for it to start ponying up for it?
Well, it's kind of $1 million or probably more to the point $1 billion question, actually, and it's a really good question. And there aren't any easy answers. Yes, you can pull a lot of stuff off of Facebook or Twitter or whatever else, and somebody's created that content and you can just haul it down and have a look at it. So that doesn't do a lot for the creative originators or the reporters who or the publishers who are originating this content. There's a lot of ways now in which various publications are finding ways to pick your pocket anyway. I mean, some of it is paid for by ad revenue still. Some of it is paid for actually by philanthropy, mm-hmm. not so much in Canada because our laws are not very free that way, but in the US in particular, there's subsidies to things like National Public Radio and ProPublica and some of these great outfits like that, where someone's just decided, look, journalism should happen and we'll pay for that, and that helps get the content out there. There is much more collaboration now between media platforms than there ever was. In the past, everybody competed to get the news out first. These days, I think we're finding that the news is coming from so many channels and so many places and everything else that it's very hard to monetize just straight news. So I think people are finding ways to monetize analysis of the news. And from a practical point of view, I'm a media consumer just like you are. I can pick up my phone anytime and just press a button and I can see a news feed that tells me about what's happened somewhere in the world. And I don't even know where the content comes from, and I frankly don't care. So I can get that. I can find out there's been a car crash or a celebrity's costume has failed or mm-hmm. Something like someone's just gone into rehab, and I can find that out really easily. What is still monetizable, I think, is, and there's some proof of this, is what's the analysis of the systemic issues, and this goes back to what we're reporting has always been an important part of our infrastructure in our democracies and in our societies. Let's get beyond the bus crashes and the costume failures and find out what is actually happening underneath. Why do these things keep happening? What are the systemic issues that continue to plague First Nations communities, and why is that? You know, what's underlying that? So people want that information. They want someone to help make sense of their world. They want someone to go deep. And, you know, some of the European crowdfunding models and other things that I look at in the book do give some indication that people are prepared to pay for that. And not only are people prepared to pay for it, even young people are. Young people are prepared. You know, we think they're all sort of airheads looking at clickbait and, you know, answering Snapchat. But there's a lot of kids there who are really interested in what's going on in their world. We just need to find where they are, and they'll pay for it.
So when you look for news and context, I mean, a lot of us in this country turn to the CBC, one, because it's reliable and we pay for it in a way.
We pay for it, absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at the ratings for radio, for example, CBC Radio, and they've never been higher.
Right.
So they're obviously doing something right. In terms of how they're funded, can it survive simply waiting on a government or whatever government's in office at the time for its funding?
Well, there's yes and no. We saw in the Harper years that Harper slashed, you know, $150 million or something out of the CBC over the years he was in power, and that's being promised to be restored by Trudeau and company, which isn't necessarily a good thing if it just allows the CBC to go back to doing what it was doing. I think, for instance, that, you know, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from here. I'm from Australia. I grew up with the ABC, which is the Australian analog, and that is totally government-funded. I mean, they get a very small trickle of revenue from some sales of things and everything else, but essentially, just like the BBC, it's government-funded. The BBC is funded by a broadcast license, and, you know, everybody in England pays for that. So I actually think one of the best things that could happen to the CBC would be that it was commanded to no longer take advertising revenue, and that would obviously cut its budget. But in fact, that we find a way, that the CBC finds a way to be relevant enough to Canadians that they are prepared to pay for it, and even if they're not, it becomes part of the tax base. I think that would be great. It would help the CBC go back to what it should be. You know, I don't think Canada needs a broadcasting corporation. In broadcasting itself is such an old idea. And if you think of the television broadcasting, for instance, the numbers for the CBC are dreadful.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think you could go door knocking in Vancouver and just tell people the news rather than have CBC television news here locally. But radio is strong, and the CBC.ca, their web presence, is very, very strong. But the CBC should not be a broadcasting corporation. It should be, in my view, and I say this in the book, it should be a storytelling service. You know, what this country needs is the constant articulation and refreshing of really important narratives about who we are as a country, you know, what we're trying to achieve in our society, who's winning, who's losing, how do we help who's losing, in a sense, in a democratic society, and float everybody's boat a bit higher. And also, how do we include voices and communities who have been historically excluded from the conversation about what this country is and could be? And in particular, I think, obviously, of our Indigenous people, and I also think, increasingly, of the sort of diverse communities that have grown up around our immigration and refugee policies and our invitation to different people to become part of this country, and yet they're not very much part of the dialogue that's going on in this country. So the CBC as a service, telling stories and helping, using the channels the CBC has, which we've paid for. I mean, we've paid for the tremendous infrastructure the CBC has, and I think they're misusing that, and I think that one of the conditions of them getting some of their funding back should be that they really think hard about re-engaging with Canadians in a very, very different way that is not competing with the same sort of stupid broadcasting you can get from commercial channels.
You know, when you said that the CBC should become a storytelling network, I almost fainted because I thought, well, he must mean Stuart MacLean 24/7.
God. You know. No, I have to say, and I'm a bit rude about Stuart in the book.
Indeed.
I think that Stuart MacLean is part of the problem, not part of the solution.
You know, we'd be here with David Morley all the time rather than, you know,
oh my God,
important issues.
Yeah.
So when you look at, because, you know, I mentioned in the off the top that you worked at the Sun.
Right.
When you look at the Sun today, I mean, you must be horrified.
Yeah, it's tragic, actually, what's going on there. And and I've still got some friends who work there, although there's fewer and fewer. I've probably got fewer and fewer friends for a start because of the book that I wrote. But also, you know, I've watched very good journalists be sort of cashiered out of there with these buyouts, or some of them have just left in disgust or been fired or whatever else. So, you know, when I worked at the Sun of the 80s, it was a not bad paper. You know, it had its problems then. They got exacerbated by the changes of ownership and the sort of declining business model over the years. And now I don't even frankly know why the Sun publishes anymore, which is not to say that there aren't good journalists working there and that this, you know, that there are people doing worthy and worthwhile reporting and everything. But the problem is the infrastructure of a paper like the Sun and the business model it has and the debt obligation that Post Media has and is constantly serving everything else is so totally out of shape for the amount of, you know, good original reporting that emerges from there that I don't see, you know, why in a sense the infrastructure of something like the Vancouver Sun can produce as little as it does. And so I sort of think of the Sun as being this sinking ship, frankly. There's still a few people inside there. You know, the hull's rusted and there's holes, it's shot through with holes and everything else. It's a terrible analogy, I'm sure. But, you know, there's still a few people in there rowing very hard. You know, they're good people. They're working to keep the Sun afloat. And, you know, they are good people and they deserve to be treated well. But the problem is, you know, they're never going to reach the shore in that boat. I mean, they just aren't. And so, you know, how do we preserve what is good about journalism without preserving what is bad, which is you've now got these vehicles that are exhausted, that are overstuffed, they've got too much bureaucracy, they're spending too much money on the wrong things. You know, how do you get back to spending money on journalism, really, is the fundamental question here.
Yeah, I had Max Fawcett on recently, and he made the point, and a lot of people, not only him, but a lot of other people are making the point, that on this whole Vancouver real estate thing that we've been talking about the last year or so, the paper, the city's paper of record, The Sun, has been virtually absent from the discussion.
Well, and you don't have to go, you don't have to be a genius to draw a line between where The Sun has derived a lot of its revenue over the years, which is from the development community, and, you know, its inability to report, terribly profoundly or honestly about these issues. And that has been a problem, I think, at The Sun for a long, long time. Frankly, that, if you think about one of the other problems with traditional media being the absolute erosion of trust that has occurred, and it has occurred, and, you know, there are surveys that show that millennials in particular don't trust mainstream media, partly because they don't talk to them in a language they understand, but partly because they realize these media are still beholden to advertisers and investors, so it's not just the hedge funds, you know, asking for their debt to be paid down, but, you know, advertisers have always had a vastly disproportionate influence over coverage and over what the risk-taking or risk aversion on the part of a lot of media who don't want to offend advertisers. And that just shows all the time. It shows so transparently that people realize that they're not getting, I don't want to sound too biblical about it, but they're not getting sort of pure product anymore. You know, there's so many contaminants in the relationship between a paper like The Sun and its readers that the readers are just turning off, you know, and who can blame them? So, you know, some of what I talk about in the book is some models emerging in Europe in particular, where, you know, there's a Dutch example I talk about where basically they produce extraordinarily good journalistic product, deep, insightful, thoughtful journalism that creates a really important and vibrant public discourse. And they don't have any advertisers and they don't have any major investors. What they have is subscribers, people who basically say, we trust you to deliver us the sort of insights. We can participate in that. We can engage with you in a meaningful way, not just writing some three-paragraph letter to the editor. They actually have forums in which people actually engage in the discourse in a meaningful, real way. And people are paying for that, you know, and so, and why wouldn't you? I mean, that's something, you know, that contributes to your community. So there are models in which, you know, it's possible to see the emergence of a trust relationship and an engagement relationship, which has long since kind of left the building at some of the big papers and even some of the big broadcasters.
So having like a big like a proprietor, say like Bezos in with the Washington Post, or what's the guy in Australia, Graham Wood, I guess.
Graham Wood.
Yeah. Is that era over as well?
Well, not necessarily, but you know, I mean, so the big media mogul era.
Yeah. Or having one owner, like the Sun had for years, had you know, a local family owning the paper, right?
That's right. Yeah, and so, you know, maybe not. I mean, I don't think the era is entirely over. There will still be people occasionally who just decide, look, you know, I want to, you know, the best way to control what you see in the newspaper is to own it. I'm not entirely sure that model's gone away. But, you know, I do think that I would love to have in Vancouver one or two or three newspapers which are locally owned by people who, and possibly put into a public trust like a foundation like The Guardian runs on that model, for instance, although it's running out of money on that model at the moment. But, you know, why can't we have, I mean, Vancouver bills itself now as a world-class city, and we certainly have world-class real estate prices. You know,
yeah.
We do not have world-class media. We don't have anything that even comes close. So somewhere on the line, is it a philanthropist or is it somebody with a very, very deep pockets who decides, you know, I want this city to be taken seriously, and part of taking the city seriously is having serious media here and funding that. So that's what Graham Wood did in Australia, because he was basically appalled at the stranglehold that Murdoch in particular had on Australian media. He liked The Guardian, so rather than invent his own product, he went to The Guardian, or they went to him, I don't quite know how it went down, and he put upwards of $20 million on the table to bring The Guardian into Australia, and there is now a Guardian Australia. There isn't a Guardian Canada yet, but there could be. There's another funder in the U.S., for instance, who put up $10 to $12 million U.S. a year for several years to create ProPublica. Basically,
yeah,
we think investigative journalism is important. Go do that. You know? And you don't have to come back and satisfy me that you've got a number of advertisers and everything else. I mean, they do have impact measures and outcomes they need to achieve. So that's possible. I'd love to see, you know, profitable newspapers in Vancouver, in Victoria, or in Prince George, and other places, which are actually almost owned by the local community. You know, the more we can get back to that level, then you build trust, because those proprietors and those owners are part of a community, and they know that they've got to show up for their community if the community is going to continue to support them by buying them and advertising in them. So, or you use the digital revolution that we're right in the middle of now to break down some of those silos, and you create bespoke products in different jurisdictions, in different regions, in different towns and cities and communities, which don't rely upon massive eyeball, you know, retention, but are just attuned to what's going on in communities. I mean, First Nations communities, for instance, they use Facebook a lot. Why couldn't there be, in some of these small communities, just some local person who, you know, does some stomping around the neighborhood on the res and does some reporting? And maybe that pays a little bit, maybe it doesn't pay much. I think we're starting to see this emerge, and one of the great things is that all the technology you need to do that is actually on your iPhone. So, you know, so the tools for reporting are changing, and the possibilities are emerging that are pretty exciting, but Do we yet have a digital product in Canada, for instance, that stretches from coast to coast, or she to shining she? Do we have something that rivals digitally, say, the Globe and Mail, which is pretends to be a national newspaper, which it isn't, but in any event, we need somewhere to start to produce digital journalism in a form and with the depth and expanse of the country that people in Ottawa or Victoria or Halifax or, you know, Queen's Park or wherever take these digital products just as seriously as they take the old legacy newspapers. The legacies have got to get out of the way and create space for that.
Well, what do you all do at Discourse Media?
At the risk of being immodest, what we're trying to do is build just the model I was just talking about. It's very early days, but we are finding ways to fund long-term, in-depth investigative journalism and feature writing that used to be a basic part of what any good media did. We don't have advertisers, so we don't have to please them. We have some small private investment, which is thankfully at the moment we're not beholden to anybody to satisfy anything other than the fact that we do good journalism. We've had a little bit of philanthropic support, and the rest of what we do is on an agency model, basically fee-for-service work where people want good journalism to happen. We can turn up and make that happen, and they pay for it. So, and we're trying to look at what firstly is in my book in terms of where some of the solutions are that I describe, and think about what could happen in Canada and execute on that. So over the next few months we hope to be able to present to Canadians a very robust, well thought out model for basically new journalism that will help kind of turn the ship around a little bit in this country in terms of where a real public discourse can take place, that listens deeply, reports deeply, and sticks around to continue to find sort of solutions for what ails this country, rather than just to fly in, fly out, quick hit, crisis-based reporting. That's what we're trying to get away from. So that's a mouthful. I mean, what we're really trying to do is launch a national digital product with really thoughtful, engaged, in-depth journalism, and hope that Canadians will pay for that.
And so I mean, even as your book laments and is nostalgic and complains, I mean, you remain hopeful about where we're headed, aren't you?
Oh, I think there's tremendous opportunity. I mean, I just some of the digital storytelling that is taking place in around the world is absolutely extraordinary, and then the technology is liberating in many ways. In the old days, to basically get the news out, you had to own a printing press. You don't need to do that anymore. So there are tremendous efficiencies, some marvelous technologies in terms of enabling us to report much more deeply and to kind of stick around and engage with communities in a very profound way. And I think in the end, what we're beginning to see is that people are prepared to have trust relationships with journalists if you deliver what you promise.
Right.
And that's been the problem for the last 20 or 30 years, is that the promise of journalism was increasingly not delivered. So there's tremendous opportunities. The digital revolution isn't going away. And what I think we're going to find, and then people's curiosity about their world hasn't suddenly diminished. In fact, people are more curious, and so they should be, because our society is vastly more complex now, and those complexities need to be unbundled, they need to be examined, and a light needs to be shone on these incredibly complex issues, policy issues, social issues, and everything else. So the role of journalism and is not going to go away. I think the need for journalism is greater than it's ever been. So how we figure out how to monetize that, to be crude about it, so that we can continue to do this, that's the challenge that we're all confronting right now, but I see opportunity everywhere.
Ian, yours is a great book in terms of getting us started and talking about this. So congratulations on the book and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
The book is called No News is Bad News, Canada's Media Collapse and What Comes Next. It's published by Greystone in partnership with the David Suzuki Institute. Its author, Ian Gill, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.